So it's our pleasure to have Sam McDermott giving our seminar talk this week, unfortunately remotely, but still we're very happy that you were able to join us today and that he will be talking about the dark photons today.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you, Daniel, for the invitation, and thanks everybody from all around for joining. So, you know, given the wide range of expertise on this call, I wasn't entirely sure how to pitch things. So there's, in a lot of cases, there's some details that are left out. But please feel free to ask questions at any point. Just go ahead and interrupt me. And if it gets too nasty, I'll just trust Daniel to lay down the law. But please just, you know, ask questions, anything that you like. This is, you know, I guess, you know, a regular research seminar. So, yeah. So the stuff that I'll be talking about is based pretty much exclusively on these papers done in collaboration with Sam Witte, who many of you know. And then we also had some help from a very good student in Spain, and Salva Rosaro Alcaraz, and Vivian Pulan, who some of you know as well. Okay, so here's my outline. So what am I going to talk about? Why am I talking about it? And how did we go about thinking about it? In a little more detail, you know, what, why now, and what are we doing differently? So here's the Lagrangian. Probably a lot of you, when you hear dark photon, already, you know, have this pop into your minds. The point of this is just that I'm only going to be talking about a dark photon. I'm not going to be talking about anything charged under the hidden U1 that I'm presuming is there. So this is just a dark photon and nothing else, no additional dark sector. But it has the familiar kinetic mixing term with the standard model. So this is the link between the dark sector and us, and then the whole dark sector is just a dark photon. So why, you know, in 2020 am I talking about dark photons? So I would say that, and I'll go through this in a little bit more detail, but from my perspective, you know, let's say 10 years ago, dark photon, dark matter was not particularly well established or had not been paid attention to in the same way as other dark matter candidates. And that started to change around 2015, and continuing through 2018 and 19, people started to put a lot more thought and effort into how to make dark matter out of dark photons. And so then that, you know, kind of prompted us to go back to some older work and think a little bit more detail about how it all worked. And so just to give you the kind of punchline summary in case you're, you know, you have to leave early or whatever, we find about 5 orders of magnitude improvement in constraints that had been around for, you know, a few years, over around 5 decades in the dark matter mass. And we also point out what I think are some pretty exciting and interesting potential signals for future observations. Okay, so just as a very broad overview, again, this might be review for a lot of people, but it might be just helpful for some people who are not exact experts. I think that by and large, one, you know, when I think about dark matter, I kind of lump dark matter candidates into two paths, either a thermal candidate or a non-thermal one. So a thermal dark matter candidate was you know, it's called that because at one point it was in thermal equilibrium with the standard model. And once you do that, once you thermalize this, the dark matter particle, then you need to get the energy and the entropy out of the dark matter sector. Otherwise you have too much energy and entropy in there, or you have something that's hot and it's not behaving like dark matter. So somehow you have to get energy and entropy out. And that leads to something along the lines of the freeze-out paradigm. If the dark matter was never thermally equilibrated with the standard model, then you need to get just the right amount of energy into the dark matter sector. So that's the challenge for non-thermal dark matter candidates. There's a couple well-understood ways of doing that, such as the misalignment mechanism for pseudoscalars like the axion, or just generally speaking, you can always have gravitational production. You can just say, essentially, there's some boundary condition, there's some branching fraction from hot thermal energy during inflation or something like that, that you just spit out by the end of inflation, just the right amount of stuff that's very minimally coupled. That's always a possibility. So to give a sense of scale of some of the mass scales and so on and couplings that we're going to be talking about today, if one wanted to freeze in dark photons as dark matter, so if you wanted to have a dark photon that was kind of heavy enough to just be a normal kind of WIMP scale, GeV scale particle. But you wanted it to sit there and never decay, so that it was cosmologically stable. One thing that you would have to worry about would be the dark photon decay to electron-positron pairs. And that decay width is written here. And it's about 40 orders of magnitude shorter than the age of the universe if the dark photon is a GeV and the mixing angle, the kinetic mixing angle is one. So this gives you some idea that maybe you're going to need something like 10 to the minus 20 in that mixing angle in order to make a dark photon, a relatively massive dark photon, one that can decay to electron-positron pairs. You need something in the ballpark of 10 to the minus 20 in kinetic mixing in order to keep it stable for long enough to just be a dark matter candidate. If you want to compare that to the rate to freeze that particle in, to produce it, so I'm not talking about anything special here. I'm not talking about plasma resonances and stuff. That'll all come later. But just to get a sense of the kinds of mixing angles that you would need in order to at some point either freeze it in or have it be, a nearly thermal dark matter candidate. The rate compared to Hubble looks like this. And so then that kind of tells you that the mixing angle that you would want would be about 10 to the minus 10. So there's this mismatch here, and this kind of tells you that if you want to be able to make enough dark photon dark matter from just normal processes, it's not really going to work. It'll eventually decay. So you need to do something different. You can't really just rely on the canonical freeze-in thermal history stuff for dark photons. So what about the misalignment mechanism? So this is something that we're familiar with. So for instance, the axion, we know that that can equal the right cold dark matter density that we observe and redshift in the proper way to be like matter. Supposing that you get the right axion Petchiquin scale, the dimension full scale that dictates how the axion talks to standard model stuff, provided you get that right, that scale correct, and you have some order one misalignment angle. So obviously there's a lot of people on this call who've done a lot of work to kind of flesh out when this condition here is the most important one and ways of getting around that. But this is the kind of generic expectation from the QCD axion, is that, you know, you've got some parameter degeneracy, but you can always kind of cook up the right thing, the right misalignment angle in the early universe to get the right amount of dark matter that behaves like dark matter, the right amount of energy density in the axion field that behaves like dark matter to be the stuff that we see today. So you just have to give it the right kick in the early universe, depending on what this parameter FA is. But this this doesn't really work for a dark photon. So the vector modes redshift differently. For details, I would recommend reading some of the excellent original literature that I'm pointing to here. Getting into exactly all of these subtleties is a little bit far afield for what I'm going to be talking about later, but I just wanted to point out that that it's not as simple as just having regular minimally coupled scalar that you just turn on a misalignment angle for. Okay, so so this was kind of in 2012, these guys talked about maybe getting the right relic density from doing some misalignment, as well as having some non-minimal coupling to gravity. These guys pointed out that there were some further issues with that, but maybe it would still work. So so this was a very nice paper from 2015 that I think kind of changed my prior and the priors of many people in the field about how well motivated dark photon dark matter could be. And so there was this nice kind of UV complete story that you could talk about, the entire history of the universe from inflation down to the present day, and you would get dark matter and you'd have the right relic abundance. And they also talked about some detection strategies. And so things were starting to change in 2015. But there was still a kind of impediment to getting the right dark matter density, which was that they found that this mechanism kind of only worked in the micro EV or above scale, kind of a few micro EV was the lowest dark matter mass that they could generate. That was in 2015, and then in 2018 and 19, a bunch of additional papers came out with a similar set of ideas, which was very roughly speaking that you could put the energy density into a one dark sector energy reservoir. So you could put a bunch of energy into a an axion field, some pseudoscalar field or scalar field, and then you could turn on that misalignment angle. You could crank that up as high as you liked. That wouldn't decay away in any troublesome way. That wouldn't lead to any difficulties. And then you could have that field decay or kind of resonantly convert into dark photons later. So in this paper in particular, they were able to get the correct relic abundance for dark matter, for dark photon masses as small as 10 to the minus 22 eV. Okay, so the claim, the point of this whole introduction is just that the dark photon dark matter landscape is fundamentally different in 2020 than it was in 2010. So what do we have? Dark photon dark matter. What are we going to do with it? And so now we're going to try to think about ways to constrain and potentially observe it. Okay, so for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to assume that there are some, basically the initial conditions for me are going to be the CMB. I'm not really going to think about creating the dark matter relic abundance anymore. Just going to say at the CMB at that time I had the correct relic abundance. It was dark photons. It was cold dark matter. And then for the remainder of this talk, I'm going to think about the effects that dark photon dark matter would have in the bulk of cosmic history. So from the Dark Ages through through developing stars and things like that. Okay, so to go all the way back to our Lagrangian, we have this kind of unique this unique feature of the dark photon field is that it couples to the standard model photon like this. This is kinetic mixing, but what it allows is for a dark photon, if you produce a dark photon some time later or some distance later, you may measure a regular photon, and vice versa, if you produce a regular photon, then you may some time or distance later measure a dark photon instead. So there's this ability to oscillate between flavors of the gauge bosons. But something that's very important about this kinetic mixing, this product of these field string tensors, is that this contains some product of derivatives. And that product of derivatives is the momentum squared, the four momentum squared. And so that's going to lead to some really interesting effects, which I'm just going to go through in kind of cartoon form. So again, apologies to the experts. So the coupling to the dark photon in the vacuum. So if there's no charged stuff around, then you have this vertex here. Kind of scales like epsilon k squared, or again, epsilon is this kinetic mixing parameter and k is entering because of these derivatives. And the photon, which has no mass, gives you a propagator, which is just 1 over k squared. And so in vacuum, you have a Lagrangian by which the dark photon talks to every standard model current, every charged standard model particle, just by some coupling epsilon. So this is nothing special yet. This is just kind of the explanation for why dark photons can couple to standard model photon or standard model matter. But if you have non-zero density of charged particles, so cosmologically, this will be a non-zero density of electrons, free electrons, then that non-zero density of charged particles will modify the standard model photon dispersion relation. So now instead of having omega squared equals k squared, the trivial dispersion relation that we're all familiar with, so instead of having that, omega squared equals k squared plus omega p squared. So omega p is called the plasma mass. I put an asterisk here because this expression is not, this is not an exact expression. So p tilde is for, which is to say that the photon doesn't ever really have a real bona fide mass. There are other corrections that are momentum dependent. But at low momentum, this is what the dispersion relation looks like. And this plasma mass, omega p, sorry, that should be a function of number density of electrons, is square root of 4 pi times the fine structure constant times the number density of electrons divided by their mass. And again, this is just a tilde. I can give you the more exact expression. But the point is just that this depends on the number density. And so if you turn the number density to zero, you turn the plasma mass to zero, and you get back the correct vacuum dispersion relation. Okay. So the non-zero density of free electrons is responsible for the fact that you get this this modified dispersion relation. Okay, so to go back to this cartoon, once you've modified the dispersion relation or given the photon a self-energy, what you do to this photon propagator is you turn that to a k squared minus pi minus the self energy. And so in the plasma, this is what the Lagrangian looks like. So I'm just putting this vertex, and then I've got this propagator. And at low momentum, then the self-energy just becomes the plasma mass. And if I'm making the A prime on shell, which is going to be the case of interest today, then the K squared just becomes an MA prime squared by definition. So that K squared became MA prime squared. And now I can just simplify this expression to look like epsilon over 1 minus omega p squared divided by ma squared. Okay, good. So this is the mechanism behind most of what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of the talk. So is this clear to everybody? Is this totally unfamiliar to anyone? Okay, good. So this is the origin of plasma mixing in some sense. And just to give a sense of the scale, the orders of magnitude that we're talking about, so I can rewrite the number density of electrons as number density of photons times eta times x, where x is the free electron fraction. And this is roughly a nano EV at the time of at the time of the formation of the CMB. If you're more familiar with thinking about photon energies rather than dark photon masses, then that's about a megahertz. And so plasma effects are of qualitative and perhaps dominant importance for the cosmological evolution of dark photons below a nano EV. And the key fact, which I guess several people on this call are familiar with and experts in, is that this that if you have a dark photon in this mass range, the standard model photon plasma mass is scanning values above and then below that mass. And so the populations of dark photons and standard model photons will go through that resonance, and there will be a level crossing. And then the populations after that level crossing will be determined by some Landau Zener type formula. So something that is important to note is that so I'm going to be in the situation where the number density of dark photons is very high because they have a super thermal abundance. So they have so an easy way to see that is that their energy density exceeds that of the standard model photons by the time of matter radiation equality. And yet their masses are below the temperature at that time, and so their number density has to be a lot higher than T cubed. So I'm always, for the rest of this talk, considering that situation where the number density of the dark photons is very high, and so primarily the situation of interest is dark photons converting to photons. And so if I have that, if I convert a dark photon to a photon, it's possible that that could just be a regular photon that went and traveled, through the universe and, arrived at the Earth as some undetectable low energy photon. But it turns out that the optical depth for photons of that energy of nano EVs and below is much larger than one. And so any photon that gets converted, if it gets converted as a transverse mode, it will be reabsorbed very quickly. If it gets converted into a longitudinal mode, it will already be heat anyway. But the, but in any case, the optical depth for any of these photons is very large. Okay, so so here is the kind of familiar two-dimensional parameter space that I'll be talking about for most of the rest of this talk. So on the x-axis, I have the dark photon mass, and the y-axis, I have this kinetic mixing parameter. And so this like nano EV range is, you know, below that is the temperature, the masses of interest for me mostly. And so this is the state as of 2012 of constraints on the dark photon. There are some bounds put after that, which I will not really be talking about in this talk, but which I'm happy to discuss if people have questions. But so these are the existing cosmological constraints. And so where did these come from? So I should say that these bounds over here and the cosmological constraints were mostly resonant bounds, whereas these additional ones were from non-resonant processes. So the reason why I'm calling these resonant is they're from processes where the it's 2-to-2 scattering or 1-to-1 oscillation or level crossing, and so the energy and momentum of the dark photon and the photon are constrained to be related, whereas over here in this non-resonant picture, you don't have to match the dark photon and photon energy and momentum anymore. Okay. Good. So where did some of these bounds come from? So I'll focus for now on this range here. So kind of the nano EV and below scale. And so this bound from delta rho CDM came from the constraint or from when these authors calculated if the probability of a dark photon to converting to a regular photon was of order one. And so that corresponded to depleting omega CDM by about 30%. So that was changing the dark matter density by a large amount between CMB and now. And so where my paper with Sam Witte started was basically we just wanted to recalculate that bound. So we just wanted to run class and see, you know, how much better we did. And what we found was roughly an analogy with what people find for decaying dark matter or things like that, that the change in the dark matter density after CMB for a dark photon should be less than about 1% of the dark photon energy density. So for decaying dark matter, the constraints are more like 3%. Here, the constraint seems to be a little bit stronger. The mechanism is a little bit different. Instead of being an exponential decay, we're talking about something resonant. It's all happening at one redshift, so that impacts the CMB modes and the large scale structure modes a little bit differently. So we weren't surprised to find something a little bit different.
And what drives the bound? So what's the exact thing that is driving that bound?
This is so we just calculated using class. We just calculated where, you know, what the allowed change in the dark matter density would be if you had a resonant. If you had some sudden instantaneous resonant depletion of the dark matter density.
No, yeah, that I understand. But I mean, what's driving the bump with respect like to the CMP itself? So what's been changing the CMP that gets to that 1%?
So this would be like a large change in the dark matter density. So it would, after the time of CMB, so it would change low modes. So L less, below the BAO peak.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, great. Thank you.
Cool. Any other questions? Okay. Good. So then we had that result but then we realized that even 1% of rho dark matter is large compared to the binding energy of every hydrogen atom in the universe. So, oh no, did I? Right. So the bound, the amount of binding energy of hydrogen in the universe is 13.6 eV times the number density of baryons. And that turns out to be about 10 to the minus 9 times the dark energy density, the dark matter density. So we should ask, what is the effect on observables? So yeah, sorry, I don't have a plot similar to this for the case of the change in dark matter. But if you do inject this much energy into the standard model bath, and then that heats up the standard model, the free electrons in the standard model bath, and then those collide into hydrogen atoms, and then those gain, temperature, then those can be ionized. What happens to the free electron fraction? So here we're just using a single dark photon mass. So this is 10 to the minus 12 eV, which is here. And then we're showing some various ranges of epsilon. So 5 times 10 to the minus 13 in epsilon is here, which corresponds to something in this ballpark up here. And so what happens is at the redshift, when the plasma mass of the universe equals 10 to the minus 12 eV, which you can read off from up here is around a couple hundred, then the free electron fraction spikes immediately. And then if the kinetic mixing parameter was large enough, what would happen would be that there'd be so much energy dumped in that you would residually have a relatively high baryon temperature. And so essentially it'd be like starting the clock back at higher redshift. And so you would, start to have a, you would have a higher free electron fraction, which would then try to cool and recombine.
So Sam, can I ask you a question? Does the fact that you start increasing the electron fraction change the plasma mass so much that you go out of resonance?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the, let me see if I have that slide in my three slides. So this might give some sense of what happens. So here you can imagine changing the width, the in Z over which you inject the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So in that previous slide, I think we were always taking 0.5 in Z implicitly. just so we had some definite number to model. But you could imagine changing that and just seeing if the results are sensitive to that. Putting in the back reaction on the plasma, the ability of the electrons to cool. So if you change the temperature by that much, if you change the temperature by enough to change the plasma mass, then you're changing the free electron fraction enough to change the plasma mass. And so that's essentially this effect. So then you turn off the resonance. Mm-hmm. The resonance does turn off, but you are kind of by definition left with a large XE.
Sorry, I'm confused about what your delta Z assumes, because here you're saying you're still injecting the same total amount of energy, but now you're doing it in less Z. I mean, if you shut off the resonance, then you only have managed to efficiently convert a small fraction of the A prime mass, A prime energy density to ionization.
Let me compare. So there's a slightly different thing that I should show you then. So this plot might be helpful. So here's the time scale, over which the various processes are happening. Can you see this?
Yes.
So the time scale over which the resonance is happening and the time scale over which free absorption is happening. And that's the time scale over which the free electrons get heated.
Okay.
Those are very short.
How do you define tau resonance?
Tau resonance, that's a good question. I should have that in my head. So that is, sorry, I don't have an answer for you right now.
Continue, I don't want to sidetrack you too.
I should have a better answer for you, but
let's go to the end. Continue, Sam. I don't want to sidetrack you right now.
Yeah, sure. But in any case, it's something that we thought about, and it's subdominant to the timescales for collisional ionization and the timescales for Hubble expansion.
I see.
Good. So I'll try to give you a better answer soon. Okay. Good. So there's a large change to XE, to the free electron fraction, which would then correspond to a big change in the optical depth to reionization. And so this is our constraint from not ionizing too many hydrogen atoms. Okay. Good. And so now, just moving to slightly lower masses. We also derived a bound from injecting too much energy in the redshifts after hydrogen reionization completes. So if you're kind of following along, using this upper y-axis to look at when different things are happening, the map between Z resonance and MA prime becomes not one-to-one anymore. After Z of 10, then reionization happens, and that increases the dark photon, or sorry, the plasma mass. And then you and after you've reionized, then the universe is back to redshifting and cooling, and so then you kind of have Z resonance that then doubles back and then starts to fall again. So in any case, this sound is coming from injecting too much energy after hydrogen reionization completes, when we have some observations of the universe. So let me just show you what those observations look like. So here's a plot from this paper from 2018. And so these black points with error bars are measurements of the IGM at redshifts between 2 and 5. And so if these colored lines are various models. So if they assume that there is no helium being reionized a second time, so this bump here, in other words, is evidence of a second helium reionization. So the universe is has reionized hydrogen and it's reionized helium one time, and then structures continue to form, and more ionizing radiation gets emitted, and then you can ionize the second electron of helium, which is more deeply bound, and so then that then frees up some more energy for you, and so this bump here is evidence of a second helium reionization. This red dotted line is the expectation for the IGM temperature if there was no helium reionization at all. This gray line is essentially the minimum amount of additional energy injected that's compatible with their measurements. And then this purple line is the maximum. Yeah.
Do you know in what way this temperature is measured?
I didn't quite hear the question.
The question is, do you know in what way this temperature is measured?
They are looking at, the short answer is no. I mean, they're looking at, Lyman alpha. So they're looking at the temperature of the IGM in the vicinity of Lyman alpha emitters, but I don't have any more detail than that. But this paper is pretty long and detailed. Yeah, sorry. Any other questions? Okay, that's a good question. So just to get a scale, in particle physics units, So this y-axis is in units of 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And so 12,000 Kelvin, which is from 0.5 to 1.7 on this scale, which is kind of brackets the whole range of values that they measure, that corresponds to about an EV. And so that's kind of the difference from assuming that, you know, in reality, there's no helium at all being reionized at this epoch, that instead somehow it got reionized with the first stuff back at Z of 7 or 8. And instead maybe all of this is coming from some anomalous source. That's one possibility. And so this line here shows you where you're injecting about an EV per baryon. From resonant conversion of dark photons. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Good. So if that was the whole story, then that would be the end of the talk. But that's not quite the whole story. So far I've just been presenting some picture whereby the universe is perfectly homogeneous and has one single plasma mass everywhere. And why that's nice, why that makes things, you know, easy and tractable, is that there's just a single redshift at which the resonance condition is satisfied when the dark photon mass equals the plasma mass. And so the probability of converting just has some delta function in redshift. But instead, if we include the effects of inhomogeneities, then this gets modified a little bit. And now, given some overdensity, so if you tell me you've got a special overdensity that you're interested in, then there will be some special redshift at which there is the resonance condition is satisfied in that overdensity. But we actually know that there is a range of overdensities present at every redshift. And so now the probability of converting depends on the redshift, but in a way that depends on the overdensity that you find yourself in. So I should say that, you know, this has also been considered by these authors, some of whom are on the call, I gather. I should also say that Joseph Pradler and collaborators have thought about this as well, but they've thought exclusively in the context of photons converting to two dark photons, and so that's kind of the complement of the case that I'm considering. So they're not talking about dark matter, they're just talking about the existence of dark photons in the spectrum at all. In any case, this idea is out there. So how did we contribute, or what did we think of that problem? So here's just a kind of graphical representation of what it means for there to be some overdensity dependence. So if you're familiar with looking at this plot, then you've probably absorbed all of its information by now. If you are not familiar with looking at this type of plot, then you have no idea what's going on. So just to go through it somewhat slowly, on the x-axis is the redshift, the y-axis is the overdensity value, which would allow you to convert a dark photon of this given mass, 10 to the minus 13 eV. So if I chose a different mass, this plot would look different. And then at five redshifts, I've shown the probability to have a resonance, an overdensity of that value, assuming some model for the distribution of overdensity. So assume some log normal probability distribution for this parameter delta. And so you can see that even over kind of, you know, 15 or 20 slices in redshift, the height of this probability distribution of this shape, which is, sorry, at every redshift, this is a probability distribution. It's just chosen to be symmetric. It could have just looked like a little lump, but instead it looks like a violin. It's called a violin plot. And so you can see that at, you know, as you go to lower redshifts, this violin gets taller, which just means that the overdensities are growing. And so, you know, overdensities that are overdense are becoming more overdense. And so this is just getting spread out. And so the probability of converting, if I was in a perfectly homogeneous universe, would be zero everywhere until I got to redshift 51 or so. And then it'd be zero after that. But in an inhomogeneous universe, the probability is, you know, of order 10% for about 15 or 20 slices in redshift. And this this shaded band, these shaded bands tell you, give you some kind of indicator by eye over what redshift range 50% or 90% of this dark photon's energy would get deposited. Because once you go beyond that, then the tails become so narrow that you aren't depositing much more energy. Okay, here's the same kind of plot, but now I'm showing it for multiple dark photon masses. And so this solid line is telling me, you know, that same value of the overdensity that I need in order to resonantly convert. And I'm just showing you on the, you know, where it intersects one, I'm just showing you the PDF at that point. And so this is kind of what I was saying about the redshift not being in one-to-one correspondence with the plasma mass due to reionization. So as you go through reionization, Xe jumps, and because Xe goes up, then the required value of delta goes down. And so you can see this for a couple different masses. Okay, good. How much time do I have? A few minutes. So the constraints depend on models of how structure is formed. So they depend on exactly what these, you know, PDFs look like. And the constraints also depend on the observables. So the observations during this second helium reionization epoch, those are probed by looking at Lyman alpha systems. So quasar is emitting Lyman alpha photons, and then those are passing through underdense regions, and those underdense regions have some, you know, need to have some overdensities within them in order to have the ability to absorb that light. And so then that, the fact that you need to have the underdensities and the overdensities, you need to have both of those, means that you have different sensitivities. So there's this window function S that we define that tells us whether or not different values of the overdensity are actually sensitive to this energy injection. Meaning, if I injected all of my energy at delta B of 10 to the 4, I wouldn't have any possibility of seeing that because all that light would be absorbed. And if I injected it at all 10 to the minus 4 of an overdensity, then there's no possibility that has enough standard model material in it to get heated to have to be enough of an energy reservoir to get heated. So once we take into account features like that, then our bounds, and which looked in the homogeneous limit like this little nub, this relatively flat feature, those get broadened into this wider shape. Good.
Do I understand correctly that your constraints are coming from the requirement that you do not heat intergalactic medium too much to contradict the temperature as measured by Lyman alpha forest?
Excuse me, can you repeat, please? Can you please? I think you're maybe talking too close to your microphone. It wasn't very clear at all what you just asked.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I will repeat. So my question is it true that do I understand correctly that your constraints are coming from the requirement that you do not heat intergalactic medium too much to contradict Lyman alpha as its temperature is measured by Lyman alpha forest?
Correct.
Okay. And sorry, do you, I mean, at which redshifts do you think you know the temperature? At which redshifts do you impose these constraints?
From 2 to 6.
Yeah, but look, the temperature at redshift 2 is, or 3, we can say that it's known to some extent. But at redshifts from 4 to 6, the uncertainty on the temperature of intergalactic medium is at least factor of several. This is just a model what you show. I looked at this paper, this paper by Anor Behenavi. I know this work very well. So this is just a simulation. But if you ask what is the uncertainty on the temperature of intergalactic medium between redshift 4 and 6, I mean, I can assure you it's factor of several.
Sure. So then if you want to allow four times as much energy injection, you should shift all of our curves up by a factor of 2 in epsilon. I'm comfortable with that interpretation. I don't think that's a big problem. So then, you know, then this should move up by 2, which is roughly here. So I think that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any... I agree with the statement that we should not be, you know, too committed to things very close to the boundary.
Yeah.
But certainly deep within this boundary, we'd be talking about heating by, you know, hundreds of EV, which I think is not acceptable. Okay, good. So I'd just like to briefly mention a couple future possibilities. So one is that we could imagine pumping in so much energy density, so much energy into standard model over densities that regions which we expect to be undergoing star formation would get heated. That would cause the genes mass to exceed the genes radius to exceed the typical radius of virial overdensities. And so then you wouldn't be able to collapse and undergo the genes instability and make stars anymore. And so that looks, you know, as a function of redshift, like this, the amount of energy that gets injected. So for epsilon of 10 to the minus 14, then you make the genes mass so big that it's bigger than the virial mass. So if we see star formation in regions with delta B of 10 to the minus 2, then we would have these, you know, extremely strong constraints. Again, I mean, so that's certainly like not the most realistic scenario that we would see star formation in delta B of 10 to the minus 2. If we see regions with delta B of, you know, 10 to the 0, so totally normal regions, then that would mean that we would be able to constrain this region. Whereas if we don't see stars in those regions, which we would perhaps expect, then maybe that's, you know, some signal that this is a some new energy injection phenomenon that's happening.
But how is that a bound? Because like we don't really understand that very well. We don't really understand star formation very well. And naively, I will expect that if you inject energy, what will happen is that you will delay star formation, but yeah, eventually the halo will cool.
Yeah.
And stars will form anyway. So it's how can you translate that into a reliable bound?
So that's totally totally right. I agree with everything you just said. I would say that this is not something that I would look at as a bound. This is more of a region where you could potentially have some interesting effects from this novel late time energy injection that I don't know of similar. I don't know of similar ways of mimicking that. So it's not so much a bound as a reason to look and to think more about what might be happening with star formation there. I think I saw someone raise their hand, but I don't know how to get to that screen anymore. Excuse me. Any question?
Whoever raised your hand, just ask. What's the easiest?
Okay, just continue.
Excuse me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have a question.
I have a question.
Sorry. Can we go with Amin first? Because he asked first. Okay, thank you.
Excuse me, I don't know. When the mass of the A' goes to small values, why does the epsilon goes to infinity?
Um, when the mass of the A prime goes to small values, we're just saying that those are I guess I don't understand the question. I mean, these regions are regions inside of which, if we were to start to see stars, then that would have implications. If we were to see star formation, then that would have some, or not see star formation, that would have some implications for dark photon dark matter.
Excuse me, do you know the epsilon functions is not isthmus, I think. So you are not you don't have a isthmus minimum in the epsilon's function. I don't know why.
So you're asking why does this, why is this not flat or something?
Yes.
Good. I guess I don't have a great answer for you right now. Sorry.
Can I ask a question? Yes. Normally, in an FRW universe, which is exactly homogeneous and isotropic, we treat photons as a fluid with density and pressure. Because if you write down Maxwell type equations or Maxwell Proker equations, divergence of F mu nu or F mu nu prime plus M squared A prime or A mu equal to J, then F mu nu vanishes because it's a curl of the vector field. So the kinetic energy vanishes. And so density would be proportional to a mass. So how do you fit this into your scheme? I don't know whether this is a relevant question, but
So the behavior of the dark photon energy density is definitely non-trivial as a function of scale factor, and so I would definitely defer to the references that I gave at the beginning on exactly how that energy density changes with redshift. It was certainly a non-trivial task for the community as a whole to kind of settle on the right answer, but I think the rough picture is that you can introduce non-minimal couplings to gravity. You have a few options. You can have non-minimal couplings to gravity. You can have a special set of masses and related in relation to the Hubble scale, or you can have some more complicated dark sector where a scalar field at a particular time pumps its energy efficiently into the dark photon. And then that cools in the right way, but it's not trivial.
Yeah, because I see. So you're saying that even though the F mu nu kinetic energy is zero because of exact homogeneity, isotropy, you somehow couple to gravity, or so you get a non-trivial way of getting density, because in the case I just said, rho is just proportional to the mass, Proker mass.
Yeah, so you can get around this from either non-minimal coupling to gravity or by focusing on longitudinal modes, which behave like a scalar instead of the transverse modes, which have this behavior being conformally coupled and therefore not excited.
Yeah, because for photons, the longitudinal part doesn't contribute microscopically because of gauge invariance. And for Maxwell Proker, you can convert that into gauge invariant theory through reconverting the current. So it's it's quite a complicated problem.
Yeah, I agree. There's some very interesting physics. Good. So I will, I think I have one more slide. So another possible future signal would be from the era of 21 centimeter physics. And so this has been pointed out before, but again, we kind of deal with the inhomogeneities and stuff a little bit differently. Okay, so I'm over time, so I should just conclude. And I'll just say that the understanding of dark photon dark matter has really been evolving a lot over the last 5 or so years. The plasma mass leads to novel signatures that are quite unlike canonical dark matter, which has been appreciated for a while, but I think deserves to be revisited and thought about in more detail. And late time conversion, I think, leads to possibilities for future observations that are also worth thinking in more detail about. So thanks.
Cool. There's a way to upload, like with the, but I still don't know how to do it. So I'm just going to do it physically.
I see. You currently figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's reactions. Yes.
Oh, reactions. Oh, reactions there. Okay. Good. Cool.
Cool.
Are there any more questions?
I think we asked a lot when during the talk.
Yeah. Okay, Sam. Thanks so much for your talk. If you want to hang out with us, we have our own like perimeter chat, or we can just stay here and you can tell us whatever you feel it's interesting or.
Yeah, unless we can stop the recording.
Usually, you guys that you're working on at this point. So, what's
okay,
been
the... Okay, cool. So, the plan is that the seminar is officially over. I'm going to stop recording now.